To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is. Good morning, everybody. I think everybody would agree the world is in trouble with respect to energy. We all know we're in trouble, big trouble, actually. And one of the very first things usually mentioned as something that might come along and save us is this so-called zero-point energy. My guest tonight, Nick Cook, wrote a book called The Hunt for Zero Point. Nick Cook is an award-winning defense and aerospace journalist who for the past 15 years has been aviation editor and aerospace consultant of the world-renowned trade publication Jane's Defense Weekly. Nick is a regular contributor to the Financial Times and has written for numerous newspapers in the United Kingdom. His analysis was sought by UK, US, and other world news media during the 91 Gulf War and the 99 Kosovo conflict. In his 18-year career, Nick has visited the world's leading defense establishments and has gained access to numerous top-secret military facilities and bases in the US and former Soviet Union. In addition, Cook's two-hour documentary for the Discovery Channel, Billion Dollar Secret, detailed for the first time the inner workings of America's classified weapons establishment. In a moment, Nick Cook will begin reading totally classified documents to us. Now, naturally, I was kidding about the classified documents. However, if he wants to read us a few, that'd be fine. Nick, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Art, or good morning from London. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. That's right. It's morning now in London, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We have a suitably watery sun floating up above the London skyline here. So,
in other words, a typical London sun.
I'm afraid to say wholly typical, yeah.
Yes. Here later today, we're expecting 50 mile per hour winds. So
wow.
The weather's getting pretty wild. Nick, I think it would be worth a few moments just talking about zero point itself. Now, at this point, zero point is really, I don't want to say it's a myth. It's a hope. It's a dream. But we can't put our hands around it yet and start running the power plants from it yet, right?
Right. That is true. I mean, I think it is more than safe to say that the idea that this zero-point energy field exists and that it is teeming with subatomic particles that flash in and out of existence, I mean, that is the concept of zero-point energy.
Uh-huh.
That idea is pretty well-rooted in science. The problem, of course, that we all face is coming up with an engineering solution to extract that energy from the vacuum of space in meaningful quantities. Because that energy soaks everything, of course, it is very difficult to get to. So I think the concept that it is there is undisputable. It's the challenge from here on in lies in extracting it. Now,
all right.
Of course,
what is the? I'd like to understand how undisputable it really is. What is the best evidence for the existence of zero point energy?
Well, there are a number of experiments that have been carried out. I mean, one of the best known is the Casimir experiment. Now, some people do dispute whether the Casimir experiment, which basically involves the placing of two plates. Flat plates very close together.
Metal, right?
Metal plates very, very close together. separated by an infinitesimally small distance. Now, the pressure of the vacuum of the zero-point energy field presses those plates together. And that, in most people's eyes, certainly the supporters' camp, definitively proves that there is this thing, the zero-point energy field. Now, of course, others do dispute this, but in general terms, I think it is accepted that the zero-point energy field stemming from that experiment is shown to be valid.
How much evidence is there, Nick, that what Nikola Tesla was investigating was, in fact, zero-point energy?
Well, Tesla, of course, is a very famous case, and it's difficult to say definitively that what Tesla was tapping into again was associated with the zero-point field, but the zero-point field does appear to underlie a lot of these manifestations and effects that appear. For example, I know some of your. I'm not so familiar with Tesla. I know lots of people have made very, very in-depth analyses of what Tesla did. I kind of like to quote John Hutchison because I have made a study of John Hutchison, and I think he's familiar to many of your listeners. I mean, John is a Canadian. He's an inventor. He lives up in Vancouver, and his work, which basically involved John set up an amazing laboratory in which he used many, many different types of equipment, beaming energy into a localized area to manifest effects. Now, those effects stemmed from levitation. They stemmed from a molecular kind of disruption of the metals and materials that he put into the zone of influence. There were moments in which those materials appeared to be there and disappear, almost as if for a while they were there, but in some other dimension. Perhaps.
Have you been an observer of his experiments?
I haven't been an observer of his experiments, but I have spoken to people who have. One of them, John Alexander, Colonel John Alexander
of
INSCOM, I'm sure, again, a name more than familiar to many of your listeners.
Yes.
I have spoken to at length about John Hutchison, and John Alexander was the head of an evaluation team backed with Pentagon money that in the 1980s went and evaluated the Hutchison effect.
Yes, well, he has expressed some reservations, though.
His reservations were based on the fact that when they came up and did the experiments, the full manifestations of the Hutchison effect were not seen. But John has gone on the record, he certainly told me, that four out of the five evaluators of that team came away believing that what John Hutchison was saying was essentially valid. There was one skeptic in the camp, and he could not be convinced. But in many ways, this whole debate, this zero-point energy debate, is one of mindset. If you are predisposed not to see this, not to see it coming, then in my experience, no amount of persuasion is going to change your worldview.
Well, yes, but that would seem to suggest the ever-so-subtle nature of it. And if we're talking about something so vast, so giant, and ultimately so powerful that we can run our cities on it, that's a big thing. That's not a subtle thing. And if the demonstration is subtle, then, I don't know, maybe it just does not have enough impact to suggest that kind of ultimate power.
Well, I think it is both of these things. I think it is a field that is there to be tapped into, and I do know of some inventors who claim to be doing this. In fact, I've seen enough data from what they have been doing to believe that they are doing something interesting. It's difficult to be definitive at this point, but I think it is also a subtle thing as well. I think it may underpin concepts for non-local intelligence, for being able to a medium by which perhaps we are able to do some rather extraordinary things like remote view. Perhaps clairvoyance might have some of its origins in the way that non-local intelligence is able to be transmitted instantaneously from one place to another.
All right, Nick, have you and I had a talk about my antenna?
We did. You did mention your antenna last time I was on the show.
Right.
Has there been any new activity there?
Well, I just don't, and have never had explained to me adequately what it is that's being observed here. Of course, I built this as an antenna, not a gatherer of any sort of energy. Thank you very much. I didn't expect nor want it. But this antenna's fed up at 100 feet, and then you're talking about 3,200 feet of number 10 wire on 13 towers. It's a very, very large antenna, Nick. And on a clear, calm day with no clouds and no, you know, nothing going on in the atmosphere to account for it, there's well over 300 volts that's constantly on that antenna, which will shock the you-know-what out of anybody who deems to touch it. And we have experimented to some degree with it. Rise time, for example, you can take it and ground it, and then the next instant that voltage is right back as though there was no build-up time. It's just there, baby. And I, Nick, had to go to extraordinary measures to protect my equipment from this voltage in terms of grounding, DC grounding, and all the rest of it all the time. 24 is it's always on ground. Has to be, otherwise the voltage would kill the equipment I've got. So I don't know what that is. I don't know why it's there. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know why it's manifested, but it is there. I've done some investigation, Nick. I've talked to electric companies, for example, because they have long unterminated sometimes lengths of electric cable that they're not using. And my theory is that there would be a similar buildup on miles and miles of electric cable. And sure enough, there is, Nick. The electric company regards it as a pain in the neck, and they ground such long runs that are being unused for that exact reason. But it is, though, it's kind of like everybody knows there's something there, but nobody quite knows what it is, and they just treat it as a pain in the neck because they're trying to pass electricity or receive radio signals or whatever. But there's something, Nick.
Is this a phenomenon that they say is particularly local, Art, or is it something they've encountered in other areas as well?
It's universal, Nick. It's universal. And as I said, the electric company, of course, well, they're not trying to collect electricity, they're trying to sell electricity. So they just ground such long runs and don't think another thing about it, which is probably standard electrical practice anyway, but they do know about it, Nick. And others know about it, and I don't know where this power is coming from. There have been theories about, well, maybe the ionosphere or atmosphere in some way is collecting an electrical charge from thunderstorms that are always going on in the southern hemisphere and distributing them through the atmosphere. That could be. It could be a capacitive effect between the Earth and the antenna or wire. It could be a lot of things, or maybe it could have something to do with some power source that we don't understand, you know, like something called zero point.
Well, I think that's the key point there, and it's so valid to this subject and others linked to it, is that there are things out there in the realm of physics that we don't understand. You know, I'm a journalist. I'm not a physicist or a scientist, but when I went to school and studied, there was this kind of view put out by my teachers that we pretty much kind of know everything that there is to know about physics.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And only really when I dipped into doing the research for the Hunt for Zero Point did I realize how little we actually have fathomed about the realms of science, the realms of physics, and there is so much. Still, so much work that is being uncovered daily. And on such fundamental issues. I mean, fundamental issues like gravity.
Well, it seems like an ignorant, insulting statement to say, well, you know, we pretty much know all there is to know about physics. Oh, my goodness. Why would somebody say that?
Well, you know, when I look at gravity, I mean, we know what gravity does. Its effects are very obvious. The fact that we are sitting where I am here and I'm not floating off into space,
yes,
is because of the effects of gravity. However,
yes,
what is not known is why a gravitational effect is induced. It is that fundamental fact is not known. There are numerous, of course, explanations for it, and the conventional one is that a mass will exert a gravitational pull on any object in its sphere of influence.
And the larger the mass, the larger the amount of gravity.
Absolutely. But actually, that's a pretty simplistic explanation. What is the fundamental root cause of that underlying pull?
Right. I'm not sure it's explained at all by suggesting it's simply mass. Obviously, I think scientifically it can be related to mass, but that doesn't mean the mass itself is the underlying engine or reason.
Absolutely. Well, of course, if you talk to the zero point energy proponents, they will say that it is the mass's movement through the zero point energy field that induces a reaction from the field, which triggers in the mass, in the atomic weight of the mass, a gravitational force.
Well, Nick, you're apparently privy to quite a bit of secret information. Something that I've always wondered about, and I know many in my audience have as well, is the famous tether experiment. I mean, you mentioned the movement, and of course you'll recall the shuttle released a tether, and it was very long and was reeled out and suddenly produced this incredible voltage that virtually destroyed the tether. You know, it just severed it at the point where it came together with the shuttle. It was an incredible amount of energy. There's never been another word about it. There's never been a suggestion to repeat the experiment, as far as I know, and there certainly has been no explanation about the amount of energy they received that literally destroyed the tether. What do you know?
Well, I wish I knew more about the tether art. I mean, we all specialize, particularly at Jane's, we specialize in various sectors, spheres. Mine is aerospace. Now, that's predominantly air-breathing aerospace, stuff that flies within the atmosphere. Of course, I'm familiar with the tether experiment, but I've never done, to be fair, an in-depth analysis on it. But, you know, like you, I've picked up on those stories, and I've wondered about it. But I would hate to mislead your listeners by saying I had an inside track in it, because to be fair, I don't.
Well, but something was fishy in orbit, I'll tell you that. The amount of electricity was so astronomically larger than what their expectations were that for them not to have commented further and or done another experiment or given us an explanation means to me that they know something we don't, a big something that we don't. That tether was traveling at a great speed, and I guess they got it low enough to begin to perhaps even dip into a little atmosphere close to it. I don't know. But it was a remarkable find, Nick, and I'll bet you somewhere there's some sort of secret document marked tether top secret.
Well, I'm hoping that in, you know, X years' time, when someone does a little Freedom of Information Act digging, they might finally get to the root of it. There is a lot out there, as you know and document on the show, that happens that we just, in the military sphere, of course, that we as yet have only skimmed the surface of. And even doing what I do, which is, you know, working as a correspondent on the very edges of a massive, sprawling defense industry, there are umpteen things which I come across which I know are rooted in heavy, heavy secrecy, and which I'm just skimming across the surface of. It's intriguing, and it's frustrating at the same time.
So, Nick, are you convinced that freedom of information requests always yield the truth?
Oh, no.
No, I didn't think so. Hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. I didn't think so. Coming to us from Great Britain, The Hunt for Zero Point, his book, Nick Cook. I'm Art Bell. Good morning from the high desert.
It's 2 a.m. and fear is gone. It's 2 a.m. The sun is still warm.
Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
From Great Britain, my guest is Nick Cook, and his book is The Hunt for Zero Point. Indeed, should we be able to find and then harness zero point, as Ronald Reagan said, it certainly would be morning in America again. It seems to me that anybody who writes for, you know, the Financial Times, Jane's Defense Weekly, these kinds of very conservative, well-respected publications, and then ends up writing something like Hunt for Zero Point, I mean, you've got to wonder how that's going to come out with, I don't know, your friends, your colleagues, the judgmental part of the world. How's it gone, having written such book, Nick?
Well, I think anyone will know from having read the book, those that have, that I was very anxious about documenting this 10-year kind of journey of discovery because it, as you say, went into some pretty esoteric areas.
Mm.
However, I am delighted to say that because of, I think, the way that I laid out my discovery process, which was on a very kind of skeptical basis, that what I was able to show was that, you know, I too came from a very, very skeptical background on this and was able to overcome that skepticism and prejudice. And as a result, I think what has happened is that I've been very fortunate in people have responded to that very well. And thankfully, I'm still, you know, I'm still with Jane's Defense Weekly, and I'm still doing work for the Financial Times and others. It's been a the reaction has been very good, Art, I'm delighted to say. And even people within the aerospace industry have responded to it extremely well.
Do you feel that anti-gravity has been actually demonstrated?
Yes, I do. A very interesting. If you go back, for example, to Thomas Townsend Brown, that was a very interesting experiment. But of course, it's not actually one which is definitively proven to be an anti-gravity experiment. Thomas Townsend Brown, for those who perhaps may or may not know his work, said that he had found a way of controlling gravitation back in 1929. Now, there's been a great upsurge of interest in Townsend Brown's work.
What was the method that he used?
Well, he used, he was charging a capacitor positively on its upper side and negatively on the lower side.
Mm-hmm.
And that what that induced was a reaction which drove this disc-shaped capacitor, interestingly, the shape of a disc, towards the positive pole. In other words, it drove the disc to rise upwards. Now, he called that a gravitational reaction, an anti-gravity reaction. There is, however, unfortunately, there's a very polarized view about that. It's recently cropped up again because of interest in lifter experimentation. Again, I'm sure your listeners have come across these lifters, but basically they replicate the Brown effect, although they look completely different. These are balsa wood models made out of a balsa kind of frame construction with aluminium foil. Again, you charge a wire positively on the upper side, you charge the foil negatively, and these lifters will rise. Is that an anti-gravity reaction? Many people, I tend to agree with them, say that it is not, that it is something called iron wind, the flow of molecules over the foil, inducing, if you like, an aerodynamic type effect.
To the person who watches the videos and the recordings, it certainly appears to be anti-gravitic, doesn't it?
Oh, it looks extraordinary, and
yes.
And I've witnessed lifter levitations and effects, and it is a bizarre experience. This thing crackles with energy. It is there's this kind of ozone-y kind of smell around
mm-hmm.
it.
Yes,
it is very dramatic to watch. It's crackling with ionization, and it's very easy, I think, to say, yep, that's an anti-gravitational reaction because it looks so strange. But at all times, it behoves us, particularly when we are moving in this world, to quantify these things, to be skeptical, to be rigorous. These, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, and we need to be rigorous. For my money, Townsend Brown's work, as interesting as it is not definitively an anti-gravity effect. Others, I think, are inducing anti-gravity or gravity-reducing experiments. I'm referring to the superconducting camp. Again, some of your listeners may be familiar with the name of Dr. Eugene Podkletnov, a man who was experimenting with superconductors.
Yes.
And who found, almost by mistake, that objects suspended above this rotating superconducting disk were losing some of their weight.
That's right.
3 to 5%.
Now, there's been quite a period of time that has elapsed since that experiment. In fact, he did measure, as you mentioned, a change in the actual weight of the object, which does seem like anti-gravity. There's been quite a bit of time that's gone by. Is there been anything that challenges the validity of that measurement?
I don't think there's anything that challenges the validity of the measurement, although, of course, what we all really want to see is someone replicating that experiment out in the open.
Right.
Now, what is, to my mind, persuasive is that you're not just getting one individual, Podkletnov, out there saying that he's doing this, he's achieving this effect. you're getting multiple people throughout the globe, at least half a dozen people, saying that they are experimenting with superconductors and getting interesting results. Now, back in May of 2003, I attended a two-day conference in Washington, D.C., which was interestingly underpinned with Defense Department money. And at that conference, a lady by the name of Dr. Ning Li, who had been employed by NASA and is a very credentialed scientist, was effectively saying the same thing, that her work in superconducting rotating disks would lead to considerable weight reduction effects, but also energy generation effects. She was talking about 11 kilowatts of energy. So it's not just Podkletnov. There are others who are independently saying the same thing. And that, to my mind, is persuasive, particularly when these people are credentialed. They have a lot to lose.
Oh, yes.
Career-wise, going on the record about this.
Yes, indeed. Nick, so there you have what you just described. Now, if there's really something to this, then surely our governments must be far advanced from what we're hearing about, or do you think they're clueless? I mean, after all, Nick, so many of us have had these objects not fly, but float above our heads. I had one float above my head. It was clearly defying gravity, not dependent on gravity nor the amount of air under any sort of surface to keep it afloat. This thing defied gravity. I've seen it. Millions have seen it. I hate to drag you over into the UFO corner, but these things are being seen on a regularly scheduled basis, Nick. They appear to be defying gravity.
Well, obviously, in the Hunt for Zero Point, I very deliberately put the whole UFO thing on one side, Art. But that's not to say that I'm not that I'm leery of discussing the UFO phenomenon. Actually, I'm not, and I'm given kind of confidence in being able to discuss it by the fact that I've recently come across a lot of papers written within the aerospace industry itself. A very interesting one, actually, came my way a couple of weeks ago from McDonnell Douglas. Now, McDonnell Douglas, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, doesn't exist anymore. It was overtaken by Boeing several years ago. But this paper, which was written by a McDonnell Douglas engineer in the early 1960s, it's a 40-page paper, is seriously promoting within McDonnell Douglas the idea that UFOs should be studied from an aerospace perspective to gain insights onto their propulsion methodology. Now, whatever I may think about UFOs, and by the way, I do believe that the phenomenon is real.
Remember, you're only saying unidentified flying object. You're
absolutely
not saying alien. You're not saying anything at all except unidentified.
Absolutely. And you know, I think one should always be very careful to maintain that stance. These are unidentified flying objects. It is a phenomenon, but it is, in my view, a multifaceted phenomenon. There is no single unifying point description of what a UFO is.
All right. Well, what I was trying to drive through, though, is if you heard this scientist make this statement in an open conference, then why should we not imagine that, in the secret locations like Area 51 near me or all over the world, there are others, work is not far, far advanced in this area already?
Well, I've covered the activities of the black world in the aerospace field for a long time from its periphery. Of course, no one in my position is able to penetrate it with any great degree of success.
Well, what kind of hints have you had, Nick?
Well, I know what the black world is capable of on a conventional level. I've seen the stealth revolution. I've covered it firsthand. And I know that what drives the black world is a sense of vision underpinned by a great deal of money and a freedom, if you like, in which to pursue visionary projects.
That's right.
Now, if you put all of that together and couple it to a zero-point energy, anti-gravity type mindset,
yes,
it is inconceivable to me that the high payoff that is promised by that research would not be undertaken, looked at, and covered within the black world. Mm. What I have to be careful of, though, is saying, I have seen no proof that it is being done, and I haven't. What I have seen proof of, particularly in recent months and years, is that the white world of the aerospace industry is showing increased interest in zero-point energy and anti-gravity.
Now, is there any way at all to follow the money, Nick? I know the black budgets are carefully protected, but I wonder, you can always get something if you can follow the money, right?
Absolutely. Well, follow the money was one of my kind of key guiding tenets when I wrote The Hunt for Zero Point. And there are periods of time when you can follow the money. The World War II period was one of them. But, well, as you know, in the black world, that money is essentially unaccountable.
Right.
That's not to say that it is completely unaccountable. No one has oversight of it. But they know that because you can follow the money, that those budgets are very carefully hidden away.
Mm.
So you can't, in the black world, follow the money to that pot of gold, which is a flying saucer powered by some anti-gravity lift engine.
Okay. Or
at least I haven't been able to do it. But there are clues. There are clues there.
And that's what I was asking about. Where do you see clues that this kind of work might be going on?
Well, I see the clues in the white world. I have seen, for example, that the U.S. Army has pursued its own Thomas Townsend Brown experimentation.
Oh.
It's there. You can. I found it on the U.S. Army's website. Looking at their research and development activities, and that was within the last couple of years. I've also seen, and it's fascinating, this one, that the U.S. Army Redstone Arsenal, where they develop advanced concepts, for example, for ballistic missile defense, employed Dr. Ning Li, this Chinese-American lady who had been playing around with superconductors,
yeah.
And incidentally, Ning Li was saying that one of the effects she got from those, that she aimed to get from her superconducting discs, was a force field beam which would be able to deflect objects. The U.S. Redstone Arsenal in Alabama was looking and paying Ning Li to further investigate those concepts.
Why do you think the Army, Nick, of all the services to be pursuing this, you would not think Army first?
You wouldn't think Army first at all. But in this uncertain era in which we live, this era of massive asymmetric threat, to use the core parlance of the Pentagon,
mm-hmm.
wherein you can get 9/11 type incidents dramatically overturning the status quo in an instant, what you are looking for as an antidote is a truly transformational weapon system, something that totally leapfrogs the state of the art. Now, something like Ning Li's force field beam, which incidentally as well was reflected by Dr. Eugene Podkletnov working over in Finland, who was saying exactly the same thing. If you can deploy that beam, point it into space, deflect a rogue incoming nuclear warhead, or for that matter, somebody you consider to be the bad guy, his satellite, you can do extraordinary things. Things that to a simplified eye would appear nothing short of magic, but which actually is firmly rooted in some pretty far out science. So all of these things, I think, are now on the agenda. That's why the Defense Department is looking at transformational weapon systems like this, like microwave weapons, lasers, and other directed energy devices.
So this Chinese scientist you were talking about, she works for us, for the Defense Department?
She does. This was a contract. fact, she was paid, her company was paid $500,000 by the U.S. Army's Redstone Arsenal to further develop her superconducting rotating discs, specifically to develop these force field effects.
And exactly how far along do we know her to be?
Well, this is an interesting one, because I met and interviewed her at this conference in Washington 2 years ago. But and she was quite forthcoming. She didn't want to discuss her military work. She struck me as an enlightened individual who would like her work to be done for peaceful purposes, but she's caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, in that she knows that the best, perhaps the only means of short-term funding is through the military. But what she was saying was that she was very close to developing hardware, and that this
anti-gravity hardware.
Yeah, this is a force field beam, what Podkletnov terms a pulsed anti-gravitational beam, to which she was saying would generate 11 kilowatts of energy. Now, in an initial application, that's quite a lot, but in its
But with what kind of input to achieve this?
You are you're talking about a jolt of electricity into the influence of the superconducting disk of a couple of million volts. So
to get it going,
to get it to you're sending this it's a pulsed beam.
Yes.
It's a zap, if you like.
Yes.
But this pulse is generated by an intense burst of electrical energy, which is then fed into the superconductor, which is inducing these strange anti-gravitational or gravity shielding effects. And you are sending that pulse along a linear path of some considerable distance.
All right. Hold it right there. Nick Cook is my guest, writes for Jane's Defense Weekly, Financial Times, and lots of eyebrow-type publications in Great Britain. He's here telling us what he knows, and sometimes this kind of guest, you've got to read a little bit in between the lines.
Mississippi in the middle of the dry spot.